We were just talking bad about you, don't worry.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and get the Senate Committee on Judiciary open. We're going to start with some public hearings. The first one we're going to start with will be House Bill 3111A. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3111A changes the award of attorney fees from prevailing party to prevailing plaintiff in unlawful trade practices cases, allows defendant to recover attorney fees if a court finds there was no objectively reasonable basis for bringing the lawsuit. This one passed the House Judiciary Committee. There's no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So, Representative Call, Representative Richardson, why don't y'all come on up? Thank you for coming over and giving us the overview, and whoever is going to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3111 is a return to the law that existed before 1995.
Dennis, I need you to put your name
on the record. I'm Dennis Richardson, state representative for District 4. And House Bill 3111 merely amends Oregon by statute 646.638, which is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and returns it back to what it was before 1995. At that time, there was Senate Bill 601, which was a 56-page bill that had 49 separate statutory provisions, and one of them changed the way attorney's fees were going to be awarded in cases involving the UTPA. This merely says that the bill that we have today merely reverts back to what it was before and says that if the plaintiff prevails, then there will be attorney's fees awarded to the plaintiff. If the defendant prevails, then if it was found that essentially it was a frivolous lawsuit, then there would be attorney's fees given to the defendant. This will enable, in very small cases where there has been egregious acts by commercial vendors, a citizen to be able to go forward, where presently under the current law they just can't afford to take the risk of having to pay the attorney's fees in a small case, even if they're very deserving.
Okay. Nick?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Representative Nick Call from House District 49. To follow on with what Representative Richardson discussed, the UTPA is originally enacted struck a balance. The language in the act apportions liability or only assesses liability as a result of the willful use or employment of the methods that are outlawed. And so automatically we have a pretty high bar struck, pretty high bar placed for conduct under the Act. Moreover, the original language to which we're returning to says that the court may award reasonable attorney fees to a prevailing plaintiff. That is a non-mandatory standard in the statute which we're returning to. The objective that was struck, or the goal that was, the balance that was struck here was in those cases where a willful act can be shown, an egregious behavior on the part of a business can be proved, then a plaintiff need not fear an irrational verdict, need not fear having to shoulder not only the costs of their own attorney's fees, but after the 1995 amendments, not fear having to pay the defendant's attorney's fees as well. This is a small group of cases. We're not here coming in with a 56-page bill to undo 1995's major tort reform bill. What we're trying to do is say that whatever the merits of that bill are, this was one small section that we think went too far. We're not trying to do anything radical here. We're not trying to increase the statutory minimum from $200 to another amount. All we're trying to do is put the bill back to put this act back to the way it was, such that that small group of plaintiffs who have a reasonable action against a business that's really far out of bounds can get their case into a courtroom without fear of an irrational verdict bankrupting them or putting them behind the eight ball.
Great. Thank you for the comments and testimony. Questions? Senator Volquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me a couple of examples, counselors?
Certainly, I'd be happy to do that. Mr. Chair, Senator Volquist, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act protects such things as perform service on or dismantling of goods when not authorized by the owner or the apparent owner thereof. And so if you have a situation where you're getting an elderly person's getting something repaired and they take it into a repair shop and they get a call back saying, I've taken the item apart and it's worse than I thought and you're going to have to pay more than what you may have expected for me to get this taken care of. And they say, well, I can't afford that. I just want it back. And they say, well, it's in a box. Come and get the pieces because they've dismantled it. And so you're actually forced to go forward. Another one is a promise to make any false or misleading statements about prize or contests or promotions used to publicize a product, business, or service. I've had elderly people call me up and say, I just need a lawyer to help me collect my prize. And I've tried to explain it. This was a few years ago, but this when these were really going on a lot. And this guy came in, and we spent about an hour together for me to help him understand that, in this instance, he hadn't won the lottery, or you know, won this huge amount. And in that instance, it wasn't necessary to go forward, but it was just the fact that elderly people get taken advantage of. Another one is to promise to deliver goods or services with intent not to deliver or as promised. You get people knocking on the door saying, I noticed that you've got a problem with your roof, and I can take care of that for you, and some elderly person's afraid that they're going to have a problem, so they go ahead with it, only to find that this, you know, they don't do it. They just go up on the roof, they pound a few nails, they leave, they take the money. Well, there's not enough money in that for a person to go forward to try and stop that, nor does the government have the resources to go after such small situations, you know, when they're just taking advantage of a lot of people for a little amount of money. This merely says that if somebody's wronged and it's not a lot of money, they can take action if they choose to, but they're not going to be held responsible for all of the defense costs in the event that a verdict comes in the wrong way.
And if I might add, there's what Representative Richardson has listed, you know, there's more within the statute, but it's not the entirety of the Unfair Trade Practices Act that allows you to go in as a private plaintiff and sue. The behavior that is dealt with in here is the kind of egregious behavior Representative Richardson has talked about, things like the inducement into a pyramid scheme or passing off real estate goods that have known defects to you without disclosing those defects to the buyer. What we're talking about here is really kind of egregious behavior that's on the fringe, but oftentimes doesn't find its way into a courtroom and isn't actionable. And the broader UTPA, definitely, all of it is enforceable by the Attorney General's office, and there are resources there, but not adequate resources, which is why these specific, most egregious acts have been kind of put under a specific private plaintiff part of the statute such that they make their way into a courtroom and people can have redress for their grievances. And then the last part of that is this also acts as a mechanism by which the Attorney General can learn about behavior, which is one of the other important parts of this act that I forgot to talk about, which is that as the light of day is brought onto this behavior, those businesses that are out there, and granted, it is a minority of businesses, right? This act actually benefits those businesses that are out there acting appropriately and following the rules, because the bad actors oftentimes get a benefit from not being litigated against. And so this small group of businesses that are making it hard for other businesses and taking advantage of the average citizen, right, those are the guys we're going after. And in so doing, we have the capacity to shed light on situations that the Attorney General may want to take up further on down the road, and we can do that without the expenditure of any state resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson and Representative Call, for bringing this forward. Just for clarification, it's my understanding that under the current law, if an individual constituent or consumer comes in to seek legal advice about what he or she perceives as a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the attorney will have to explain to them that there is a risk that even if we bring your case in good faith, you will still have to pay the defendant's attorney's fees if we don't prevail. Is that the way it works now?
Yes, absolutely. That's how the statute works now. And so instead of being a situation in which we have, you know, the traditional American rule where everybody pays their own way, we've created an even greater disincentive to the consumer who's been wronged by this conduct, because an irrational verdict, a verdict that may go against the facts that are there, you know, and 50 plus 1% one way or the other, for those cases where things are kind of on the razor's edge, the plaintiff who has been wronged could actually have to pay the defendant's attorney's fees. And that conversation, and I'm not an attorney, but Representative Richardson, as he can tell you that I imagine that conversation pretty much stops any much meritorious litigation at its beginnings, such that a lot of these cases never see the light of day.
Can I make a brief follow-up? I wanted to make sure that the bill's sponsors know that in February the National Consumer Law Center did a study of all the states' similar unlawful trade practices acts, and they only found 3 states in the country where you have a situation where a consumer who brings a case, even in good faith, may have to pay the defendant's attorney's fees. Us in Florida and Alaska. So the 47 other states do not have this provision. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Mr. Chair, if you might indulge me just one second further, I'd just like to say that this is a bipartisan bill that Representative Richardson and I have run, and it passed.
We couldn't tell.
and it passed the House 55-4. We worked very hard talking with our colleagues on both sides of the aisle, making the case for this is not an anti-business bill. This is in fact a pro-business bill. And the behavior that we're getting at here is a very small part of the kinds of issues that are within the UTPA, but are the most egregious. And the benefit to the business community and to the consumers of our state is apparent. And so, because of that, we were able to get very broad support on the House side, and just hope that trend can continue over here as well.
All right. Well, thank you. Hopefully our faces today, being a Monday morning, doesn't, do us justice or whatever, but we've kind of figured with the two of you might be bipartisan, and it looked like you did very well on the House side. So thank you for your testimony. If you want to step back, I've got a couple people I think who want to testify in opposition. Tom Holt, and was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3111? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt here today on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. First, I wanted to say that I am not here to defend any violations of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. However, the statute as currently in Oregon, as Oregon law currently stands, does strike an important balance. It was an important part of the 1995 reforms, not exactly an oversight, as one might be led to believe by the size of the bill that it was incorporated in. The change that's proposed here takes away, as Representative Call very accurately portrayed, any fear of defense costs. And that is a filter on whether a case is really meritorious to bring forward. With the bill as it now stands, it would take away any downside for a plaintiff to proceed as far as possible, and perhaps even eschewing possibilities for early settlement with the possibilities of being able to go to trial and collect additional fees. So with that, I would just close my comments and be open to any questions, but we are in opposition to the bill.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. And I'll ask one more time. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 3111? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing. And let's go ahead and move into our next public hearing, which we'll go in at the, back to the top.
Yes.
So we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2584A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2584A is the Illinois Brick Repealer Bill. It passed the House, and it allows plaintiff to bring an antitrust lawsuit if they are an indirect purchaser, allows Department of Justice lawsuit to be deemed superior to the private plaintiff's lawsuit if department files within 30 days on behalf of the same class of people. There's no amendment and no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Our first panel is going to be Phil Donovan, Tina Beatty or BD Walters, and Andy Albertine, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. Here to speak in support of House Bill 2584. With me is Tina Beatty Walters, who will provide a comprehensive overview of this legislation's history and its practical effects upon passage. The graphic that I put up is just an illustration of how Illinois BRIC works, which was a 1977 Supreme Court decision that said that indirect purchasers did not have the ability to seek their injury in a court of law. And as you are aware from our conversations, the Oregon legislature tried to balance an injustice when it did a partial repeal of Illinois BRIC in 2001. And in effect, at the time, the legislature asked Oregon's attorney general to stand up for indirect purchasers. And we're here to talk a little bit about why those goals have not been met. First and foremost, the Oregon Attorney General does not have the resources to be able to effectively evaluate and participate in antitrust litigation. They just simply don't have the staffing to be able to do that effectively. And given the fiscal condition of the state, that's probably not something that's going to get any better. Nor can Oregon's Attorney General, under existing law, look out for Oregon's small and medium-sized businesses because the current law is limited to just that of consumers. So in other words, current law doesn't work for a healthy, effective marketplace for Oregon businesses, and it fails to look out for the interests of individual Oregonians. And so we seek this change in law, and by doing so, we think it provides you an opportunity to ensure better enforcement of Oregon's antitrust laws, better serve Oregon's people, and finally serve Oregon's businesses. So with that, I would close and defer to Tina.
Thank you.
Chair Podesta, members of the committee, my name is Tina Beatty Walters. I'm a partner at Stoll Byrne. My firm handles complex business litigation, including some antitrust cases. I'm testifying in favor of House Bill 2584. My materials pretty comprehensively describe the history and the background justifications for House Bill 2584, and I don't intend to fully summarize those materials here today. I do want to mention that I've submitted some letters of support in my materials. You can find those at tabs 3, 6, and 8. And I've also included a rebuttal in the materials of some of the opposition's points made in the House Judiciary Committee. What I'd like to do today is to briefly describe the problem that House Bill 2584 addresses, to provide three examples of cases in which Oregonians were denied a remedy for injuries they suffered, and to provide three examples of cases in which Oregon consumers and businesses right now are currently not represented. These are ongoing cases. House Bill 2584 is what's called an Illinois BRIC repealer. It's designed to grant standing to indirect purchasers in Oregon to enforce antitrust laws by bringing suit for their injuries. In 1977, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Illinois BRIC. And in that case, they eliminated the ability for anyone except for direct purchasers from a manufacturer to bring suit for their injuries, even when indirect purchasers could prove that they were damaged and suffered injury. If you look at the chart in front of you, that is reproduced at tab 1 in your materials. And it illustrates a typical distribution chain. And basically, products typically travel through the distribution chain before reaching their ultimate end user, either the consumer or the business. And under Illinois BRIC, only the direct purchaser, so only the wholesaler in this illustration, would have the right to enforce antitrust law to bring suit for their injury. The problem that this created is that the wholesaler, the direct purchaser, often does have the ability to and often does pass on the unlawful overcharge to the indirect purchaser. So they often have the ability to pass on those charges to the retailer, the consumers, the businesses at the end of the distribution chain. So the result of Illinois BRIC was to deny victims of antitrust violations who often suffer the majority of the harm any remedy. There are 23 states right now that grant standing to indirect purchasers to enforce antitrust law, state law, and bring suit for their injuries. 17 of those states allow indirect purchasers to recover treble damages. You can find behind tab 5 in my materials a description of the state's laws. House Bill 2584 would basically add Oregon to that list. Oregon's 2001 partial repealer of Illinois BRIC, allowing only the Attorney General to file suit on behalf of consumers only, not businesses, is an insufficient solution to the problem created by Illinois BRIC. To illustrate, I'd like to describe three cases in which Oregonians were shut out from recovering, even though they suffered the same injury as consumers and businesses in repealer states. The first case I want to talk about is the vitamins case. That was a price-fixing case against the six major manufacturers of vitamins used in products such as bread, milk, animal feed, vitamin pills. Now, prior to the enactment of Oregon's partial repealer, a massive nationwide settlement was reached for $305 million. Oregonians received nothing from that. Washingtonians received $10.8 million, $3 million of which was earmarked for businesses in Washington, including farmers and retailers who paid more for vitamins than they would have absent the price fixing. If this settlement were to happen again today under Oregon's current law, Oregon businesses would again receive nothing, even though they would suffer the same exact injury as businesses in Washington, California, and other repealer states. And that's because the Attorney General cannot file suit on behalf of businesses. The second case I want to talk about is the Relefant case. This is a case in which the manufacturers of a drug called Relefant created a monopoly in the market for the drug. They committed fraud in securing a patent, and they filed meritless litigation in order to prevent their competitors from marketing the generic version of the drug. In 2005, a $75 million settlement was reached, and with the indirect purchasers and approved by the court. The settlement funds were distributed based entirely upon which state the consumer who purchased the drug lived in at the time. The court made it very clear in approving the settlement that only consumers from repealer states were entitled to a recovery. So the repealer state citizens received 82.5% of the purchase price for Relefant during the class period, but non-repealer state citizens received only 9.2%. Those include Oregonians. So if a consumer spent, to give you a concrete example, if a consumer spent $300 over the class period for Relefant, she would be entitled to $247.50 if she lived in a repealer state, but $27.60 if she lived in a non-repealer state like Oregon. So despite the fact that Oregonians suffered the same exact injury as consumers in repealer states, Oregonians received far less. I want to mention quickly the Hytrin case. This is one that I cited in my materials as well. This is another pharmaceutical case settled in 2005. Now, the court in this case certified state classes of consumers from repealer states only. So when a settlement was later reached with indirect purchasers, it was only the consumers from the repealer states who were entitled to and received any recovery. Oregonians received nothing. And tab 7 lists ongoing antitrust cases, and those are the ones that I want to talk about now. There's 71 currently ongoing antitrust cases that are pending, that have been consolidated together by the panel on multi-district litigation. If I might quickly describe three ongoing cases in which Oregon businesses and consumers are not represented out of those 71. One is the air cargo shipping antitrust litigation. This case is pending in the Eastern District of New York. It's brought by plaintiff indirect purchasers of air freight shipping services to, from, or within the United States from 2000 until 2007. Every one of the named plaintiffs in the case is a business. They allege that defendant foreign airlines and domestic airshippers engaged in a worldwide conspiracy to fix or maintain prices of their services through a variety of mechanisms. Now, in 2005, Lufthansa, one of the defendants, reported price-fixing activity to the U.S. DOJ. They requested and were granted leniency from the U.S. DOJ. So businesses in Oregon that ship products to, from, or within the United States would be potential plaintiffs in this case, but currently they have no remedy and are not represented in the case under current state antitrust law. The second case I want to talk about is Vitamin C antitrust litigation. This case is also pending in the Eastern District of New York against six Chinese companies that are alleged to have dominated the international market for vitamin C during the five-year class period. Now, the plaintiffs include a pharmacy that sold vitamin C and a farmer that used feed supplemented with vitamin C, both from repealer states. Plaintiffs allege that the defendants formed a price-fixing cartel that caused the market for vitamin C to unlawfully increase nearly threefold over the period of a year, and at one point during the class period, sixfold. Businesses in Oregon that are affected by the alleged antitrust violation include retail businesses that sell vitamin C and vitamin C-containing products, and farmers that use feed supplemented with vitamins. Consumers, of course, are also affected. No Oregonians are represented in the litigation currently. The third case I want to talk about is the hydrogen peroxide antitrust litigation. This case is pending in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. The plaintiffs allege that the defendants who controlled U.S. production of hydrogen peroxide created a price-fixing cartel that artificially inflated hydrogen peroxide prices for 11 years through 2005. The European Union has formally charged 18 companies with price-fixing, including many of the defendants, and the U.S. DOJ is investigating and has convened a grand jury. Affected businesses include, according to one of the defendants' websites, pulp and paper and textile manufacturers in which hydrogen peroxide is used for bleaching, chemical companies, hydrogen peroxide is used for oxidizing certain compounds, consumer product manufacturers, it's used as laundry bleaches, among other things, food processors, because hydrogen peroxide is used to sanitize packaging equipment, and among other things, tanks for wine making. A winery is one of the plaintiffs in this case, a California winery. Plaintiffs also include a dye and print shop from a repealer state. So in all of these examples, Oregonians suffered the same unlawful overcharges as citizens and businesses in repealer states, but are unable to recover under current Oregon antitrust law. We think House Bill 2584 will remedy that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Andy Aubertine. I'm a partner in the law firm of Aubertine Draper Rose in Portland, Oregon. I am going to supplement my written materials, which I submitted just this morning, along with Ms. Beatty Walter's testimony. I was an assistant attorney general for the Oregon Department of Justice for 13 years, from 1989 to 2003. And during that time, I worked almost exclusively on antitrust matters. And then thereafter, in private practice, I continue to work in antitrust matters. And so that's the experience that I bring to this committee in testifying basically on three points. One, why this bill truly is pro-business, despite criticisms to the contrary. And second, why the Attorney General's staff and their resources are truly inadequate to handle all the indirect purchaser cases that are out there. And third and finally, why this bill will serve as a deterrent effect, in essence, a law enforcement effect that is contemplated by the antitrust laws both on the federal and the state level. Let me start first with the pro-business aspect of this. It's not difficult to see from the description of the cases that Ms. Beatty Walters provided that many of the antitrust defendants in these types of direct purchaser, indirect purchaser cases, where you have multiple businesses or consumers and multiple chains of distribution, that the unlawful activity is taking place at the highest level. And the highest level often means, in fact, in the overwhelming majority of cases, means companies that are national or international in scope. Large companies who enter into these types of conspiracies, and the artificially inflated price or service is then passed down through the chain of distribution. That is not the profile of the vast majority of Oregon businesses. Oregon businesses, by contrast, are small and medium-sized businesses in Oregon. We know that. We know that Oregon businesses oftentimes are end users of products or services, or are a reseller of products after they have purchased them from the distributor. In either case, they are at least one step removed from the transaction that contains the unlawful conduct. And as such, these are the businesses that suffer. These are the businesses that lose money through the unlawful conduct and are unable, under the current state of the law, to bring an action to recover these damages. And the practical effect, as we have seen in some of these cases, and you will continue to see in these cases, is Oregon businesses will be shut out of litigation in the future and settlement in the future when indirect purchaser interests are implicated. It would be a different story entirely, it would seem to me, if Oregon's business community were made up of multinational companies and we didn't look to protecting the interest of small and medium-sized businesses. But that's not what Oregon is about, and we know that. We know that Oregon here has, that is the backbone of the Oregon community. And as such, they are just as much entitled to their day in court as any other business as an indirect purchaser in other states, and any other consumer who is entitled to its day in court here. Secondly, and I think as importantly, and it was alluded to as a concept in the last round of testimony on the other bill, and I believe this to be important as well, this is particularly important on the spirit of the antitrust laws. The antitrust laws are designed to promote fair competition. It is designed to level the playing field. And as a result of that, the overwhelming majority of businesses that follow the law should be allowed to be given the competitive environment to compete with those businesses that also follow the law. And if those few businesses do not follow the law, then they ought to be punished accordingly. And that serves as, in addition to level the playing field, a deterrent effect, which I'm going to return to in my third point. My second point goes to the issue of Attorney General resources. And very quickly, I'll mention, if the committee does not already know, and I assume that it does, that the Oregon Attorney General, being the attorney for the state, must take on a number of different responsibilities over and above simply handling indirect purchaser antitrust cases. As the attorney for the state, the lawyers that are assigned to do antitrust work must provide legal advice, policy work on competitive issues to all state agencies. In addition, the Attorney General's office must be in a position to review and, if necessary, prosecute merger reviews where the combination of two large companies, whether the companies are based in Oregon or not, but do business in Oregon, combine to create a level of market power where it could harm consumers or businesses in the form of higher prices or less quality of service. Merger reviews, as this committee well knows, is a very time-intensive type of case where for 6 or 8 months the resources can be devoted almost entirely to that review as very complicated issues of market power, product markets, geographic market, and competitive effects, entry barriers are all reviewed. In addition to that, the Attorney General must also be prepared to field complaints from the consumer and the business community about anti-competitive conduct, conduct investigations where necessary and appropriate, and then determine whether and to what extent it should prosecute cases both involving direct purchasers, indirect purchasers, government agencies, which act in their proprietary capacity. And let's keep in mind, as we know, that the Oregon Attorney General is the sole attorney who represent state agencies in handling antitrust cases. Now, for all of that work, there are two lawyers assigned to do all of that. And ever since I was with the Oregon Department of Justice, the maximum number of lawyers that was ever assigned to handle all of that work was three, and I was one of them. That is simply not enough in the way of resources to handle all of the antitrust work that is out there. And it was never intended for the Attorney General to be the sole prosecutor. This gets to the deterrent effect. The antitrust law contemplates that private enforcement actions be made so in order to serve a law enforcement purpose, as a deterrent effect for businesses to not violate the antitrust laws. If a company is intending to violate the antitrust law, it at least considers itself exposed not only by government enforcement actions, but by private actions as well. And indeed, that has served as a deterrent in a number of cases. And it certainly, in my capacity as counsel for certain clients when providing antitrust advice, I make it very clear to them that their exposure is not just government enforcement action, but can be private action as well. And this serves as a significant deterrent and incentive to follow and abide by the law. So for all of these reasons, this bill serves the purpose that I believe was substantially started with the 2001 amendment in which I was involved in, but takes it the rest of the way. One thing you're going to hear, perhaps, from those who oppose, is that the resource issue can be resolved, the Attorney General resource issue can be resolved by hiring Special Assistant Attorneys General. And I will concede, and I have to concede this, because I have fulfilled the role of Special Assistant Attorney General, not only in Oregon, but in other states as well. But it is not accurate to say that when special counsel are hired to serve in particular cases, that it has no fiscal impact on the state. It has significant fiscal impact on the state, and I'll just refer you to my written materials as to the number of different tasks that in-house counsel must still serve as they move their role from a litigating attorney to a supervising attorney. And significant resources are still expended in order to handle that type of staffing, resources that are otherwise would otherwise be assigned to cases in-house. That's the extent of my testimony. If any of the committee members have questions, I'm happy to field them.
Questions?
Senator Brokwist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's Mr. Albertine, right?
Yes.
I'm not the lawyer here, so I need a couple English answers here. So pictures worth a thousand words, I guess. I think I understand that under existing law, the Attorney General can enter into a class action suit on behalf of the state. Can you describe me, first question is if he's on the prevailing side, then the state get compensation out of this and it goes to the state coffers and treasures? That's question one. And then question two is under the proposed law, there's this whole section where the Attorney General, appears to me, can get involved in it, and he supersedes or trumps or whatever you want to call it in legal terms, the citizens. And then if there's a ward in that case, what happens to the citizens? Do they still get something? Or I'm trying to figure out the practical application of this and not all the legal mumble-jumble.
Chair Pruzanski, Senator Boquist, I can field both of those questions for you. The first question is, if the Attorney General brings an action on behalf of consumers or government agencies in a class action, or as parens patriae, and if successful in that prosecution, either by way of settlement or a victory in court, the Attorney General is entitled to attorney's fees. And those attorney's fees will come back into the state coffer. There's the Consumer Protection and Education, the CP&E account, and that's where the money goes. Now, I have been out of state government long enough to know, I don't know whether there are limits to that and whether excess over and above a certain point go elsewhere, but that's where the money would go. And the Attorney General does get to keep that award. The second question that you have involves a scenario and a concern actually that was raised on the House side. Well, what if there is a class action brought on behalf of consumers by private counsel, and the Attorney General also wants to bring the same action on behalf of consumers? Which representative prevails as the preferred party to represent the consumers in that instance? And the answer is, under the amendment that was passed, it would be the Attorney General within a certain amount of time after the matter was filed as a complaint. And there would be an absolute preference to the Attorney General. That amendment more or less reflects the reality of the law nationally. It isn't
It isn't well settled, but it certainly reflects the leaning of the law, both in the state and federal level, that the Attorney General is often the preferred representative. However, as the case moves on longer and longer in the case, and the longer the Attorney General would delay in entering the case, that preference or that presumption would then either diminish or entirely go away, to the point where the court makes the decision based on what work has been put into the case on behalf of consumers. If the Attorney General becomes the preferred representative, then we are back to that situation again, Senator Boquist, where yes, they can recover the attorney's fees.
Clarifying question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, so practical example here.
Yes.
The freight forwarder air freight issue.
Yes.
So if 11 companies in Oregon hired you, we joined the lawsuit, the Attorney General looks at it, because it says you have to send a note to the Attorney General in the first 30 days. Attorney General looks at it and says, no, this impacts two or 300 people, businesses in Oregon. He joins the suit, becomes prevailing, I guess, lead counsel or whatever it is. When the award comes out, if an award comes out, does the state keep the money in the Attorney General, or do the 300 companies get some portion of it, or do the 11 companies who paid you to start with, who just got X'd out by the Attorney General, how does this work?
We need to correct something that I didn't quite understand in the question. If there's an overlap in actions between the Attorney General and private interest, it would be only with respect to consumers. And in the consumer scenario where the consumers are plaintiff, and I will get to your scenario, in the consumer case where there's consumer plaintiffs, the Attorney General would prevail. Consumers would still get money.
Okay.
But the Attorney General would be entitled to attorney's fees. The Attorney General does not represent businesses. And as a result of that, if there was a lawsuit filed on behalf of small businesses, indirect purchaser, this is not a situation where the Attorney General could come in and take over that case as parens patriae or as attorney for the businesses. The Attorney General represents consumers and government agencies, not businesses. So in that situation, businesses would be represented by private counsel, businesses would return the reward, and private counsel would get rewarded as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask if you can explain how damages are awarded versus in a repealer state versus a non-repealer state. Because as you look at the chart, under the current law in Oregon, if there's only one group of plaintiffs, if we change the law by passing this bill and then there are the wholesalers, the retailers, and the consumers who are all potential plaintiffs, what's the difference in how damages are allocated? Thank you.
Okay. In indirect purchaser cases where there are direct purchasers and indirect purchasers in the same case, oftentimes what's happened is a procedural mechanism as these cases are consolidated in the same court. The reason for that is indirect purchaser and direct purchaser cases oftentimes have many of the same legal issues or common facts. And as such, it will often be the case that the same judge or two different judges in the same district will be assigned these cases. Now, in those cases where you have a direct purchaser and an indirect purchaser lawsuit in the same courtroom or in the same district, each plaintiff group will hire an expert. And what that expert will do is calculate the damages that were incurred by the plaintiff group at the direct purchaser level and at the indirect purchaser level. And so, if the matter does not settle, and if the matter goes to trial, each plaintiff group presents at trial, maybe separate trials, but nevertheless present at trial their expert analysis on what damages each level of the chain suffered. Now, if there is a settlement, that expert testimony often will be converted into affidavits or declarations that support the monetary award of the settlement as well as the amount that's being distributed back to each plaintiff class. And in so doing, what happens is the court then has the benefit of the expert analysis in court papers to determine how much goes to the indirect purchasers, how much goes to the direct purchasers. If there are indirect purchasers that are outside of the initial litigation, such as Oregon businesses, and they're brought in by a national settlement, they may also receive some part of that settlement award. but it will be far less in many instances than if they had their own claim brought into the case. And the reason for that is, as the relevant court quite correctly pointed out, those businesses who have standing in the first place, their awards ought not to be diminished by those businesses that do not have standing. So even though they're brought in as a global settlement, which often is the case, in order to buy a complete piece in the case, the businesses that don't have indirect purchaser standing at the outset will oftentimes get far less than what the businesses would get if they had that standing. And I hope that answers your questions, Senator.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. I've got another panel that's coming up now. Jim Gardner, Tom Holt, and Betsy Earls.
For the record, again, Tom Holt for the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition here in opposition to House Bill 2584. A key argument brought on behalf of this bill is the AG is short of resources in order to bring these cases. We would suggest that that is really a management issue on the part of the AG of whether or not it's appropriate to allocate more staff or to come here to this body for more resources to be able to have those staff or to be able to go to outside special counsel. It is not a reason to upend the statute and create some inherent unfairness if open up to indirect purchasers. We've heard a lot about the plaintiffs, but let's visit for a second on the defendants. One could be a distributor in the chain and not have committed any antitrust violation, not even been aware of an antitrust issue taking place, but then be subject to litigation by indirect purchasers further down the chain and responsible for potentially treble damages or virtually unlimited damages because these multiply with each level of the distribution and numbers of plaintiffs. And that could be a potentially huge liability. So for those reasons, we would be in opposition to the bill. If you do decide to move forward with it, we would suggest that rather than award these additional bounty damages to attorneys, that they go to some public purpose.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, in opposition to this bill. I would like to say that previously in my career, I did do antitrust litigation on both the plaintiff and the defense side, including a couple of plaintiff antitrust class action. So I have some familiarity with the issues from a practical point of view, from a litigation point of view as well. I also have a lot of familiarity with this particular issue in the building because in 2001, Andy Albertine and I were basically seated at this table when we came up with the current version of the statute that is now in effect. And that was the result of legislation that then Attorney General Hardy Myers had put in place to basically do what this bill would do, which was to create full indirect purchaser standing under the Oregon antitrust law. And that a number of business entities viewed that as a step too far, because what it really does, from a manufacturer's perspective at least, is transforms treble damage exposure into sixfold, ninefold, 12-fold damage exposure, depending on the numbers of the number of levels of distribution. And you will hear arguments from my good friend Ed Burnett on the Lewis and Clark Law School faculty that he's not aware of any instance in which there has been actually duplicative awards, but what that doesn't take into account is the effect on settlements, because most of these cases, they're filed as class actions and most of them settle out. And there is, I can assure you, there is a definite impact on the settlement value of a case, depending on how many layers of distribution have standing. So getting back to 2001, the problem really was that the state of Oregon was not able to participate fully in a lot of the multi-state settlements, the vitamins case, because what the state was really only able to get compensated for its direct costs as a purchaser of products, and the state's consumers were not able to be counted essentially in those settlement discussions. But what we discovered was if we basically emulated Washington and created parens patriae standing on the part of the Attorney General for Oregon consumers, we could solve that problem. And we could solve it without creating the risk of nine-fold exposure, 12-fold exposure for manufacturers, including manufacturers doing business in Oregon. One thing I also want to mention by way, and so that was basically the deal that was struck in 2001. We had a little interim work group that looked at whether or not we should take the further step of going the route of private party indirect purchaser standing after the 2001 session, and basically concluded no, that we thought it was best to stay with the law as it had been changed in 2001. I want to also clarify that Illinois BRIC repealer is a bit of a misnomer. The Illinois BRIC is a federal decision, a U.S. Supreme Court decision, that established the doctrine that only direct purchasers have standing under the Sherman Act, under the federal antitrust laws. And the federal antitrust laws are the basic mechanism by which competition is protected in the United States. The state laws are an adjunct to those, to the federal laws, and basically are focused on in-state commerce, not restricted to that, but that's the basic focus of them, as opposed to interstate commerce. And the federal law is still as it was under the Illinois BRIC decision, so it's not changed by this bill. The discussion was, you heard discussion to the effect that this is a pro-business bill. I think that if that were the case, you would see at least some entities representing the business community testifying in favor of the bill, and to date, I've seen none. And I think the reason for that is that the perception is that this will feed additional litigation, including litigation against Oregon-based manufacturers, which is a class that we're attempting to enlarge in this state with our green industry initiatives and our other incentives to bring manufacturing facilities to Oregon. Passage of this bill will not help that effort. Finally, I want to touch on something that Tom mentioned briefly, if this committee does in its wisdom decide to go forward with this bill, which I recognize as a distinct possibility, you take a look at something we suggested on the House side, but that did not find favor with the House committee, but with a little bit of a twist. You heard a lot of discussion as we, and not only in this committee, but elsewhere in the building, about the severity of the budget crisis that we're confronting. On the 15th, we're about to get the revenue forecast. On the 18th, I think we're going to see the co-chair's budget. And one of the budget areas that has not seen gotten a lot of publicity, except perhaps in this committee and in one of the subcommittees of Ways and Means, is the Judicial Department budget, which is going to be severely impacted by the shortfall. One of the things that I would like to explore, and if the committee's interested, I would volunteer to quickly do the scut work on this, is to follow the example that we take in the area of punitive damages, where 60% of the award goes to the Crime Victims Compensation Fund, and see if there's a way to take that approach with regard to this, what's going to be essentially a windfall recovery if this bill passes, in terms of damages. And the concept would be to take the punitive two-thirds of a treble damages award, because the second two-thirds of that award are punitive. They're not compensatory. To take those, or perhaps some share of them, if you were to follow the punitive damage model at 60% of them, and
consider putting those, reinvesting those funds in the Judicial Department budget so that we can have at least a fighting chance of keeping the courthouse doors open and functioning as we go into this severe revenue shortfall. And again, I'd only volunteer to do that if the committee's interested in that. If you're not, I won't spend the time doing it, but if there's an interest in that, I'd be delighted to explore that.
All right, thank you. Betsy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. While we appreciate the concern of the prior panel for the welfare of the business community, before I get started on my testimony, I would like to tell you that I have not had one single member of our more than 1,600 contact me with concern about an Illinois brick problem or an interest in having this bill pass. On the contrary, I have had several manufacturers, Oregon-based manufacturers, let me know that they are concerned about the impact that this bill would have on their business. Adoption of House Bill 2584 will have a substantial and immediate impact on the number of antitrust cases which will be brought in Oregon, and that will send a clear signal to investors and entrepreneurs that Oregon's legal climate is hostile to business. Granting private plaintiffs, rather than only the Attorney General, the ability to sue as purchasers, both direct and indirect, will multiply the number of potential suits that a defendant could face over a single alleged incident. The number of claims for treble damages would also be multiplied. Allowing further damages to be recovered by indirect purchasers would leave a defendant, an Oregon manufacturer, potentially open to limitless liability. A single alleged incident, even if it was accidental in nature, brings multiple treble damages awards that could effectively bankrupt the defendant. Oregon, as you know, is home to a number of very small startup businesses, which are extremely promising. We've had several of those in to testify with us this session, and I never cease to be impressed by the quality of those entrepreneurs and the innovation of the work that they're doing. I think a bill in the nature of House Bill 2584 would have a chilling effect on businesses which are potentially of great benefit to the state of Oregon, and AOI opposes the bill on that basis.
All right, thank you. Questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
I just need just a minute. I think it was Mr. Gardner, you talked about the, hold on just to find my notes. You talked about the possibility of multiple damage exposure, and based on your experience and the other cases that you know about, can you cite cases where there's been multiple damage exposure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, no, because typically these cases settle out, and it increases the leverage of the plaintiff's attorney. Because the prospect is there that you could have exposures. And that was part of the testimony that we received during the interim following 2001 from Barnes Ellis at Stoll Reeves and a lot of the folks who actually litigate those cases, that it has a substantial impact and because they've litigated them in both repealer and non-repealer states, substantial impact on the settlement value of a case.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else? Let's see. I'm going to let you all leave. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 2584? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing on 2584. Open up our last public hearing on 2687A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2687A provides for rules for funds resulting from settlements or judgments involving minors for amounts less than $25,000, allows withdrawal of funds only pursuant to a court order when the minor becomes an adult or upon the minor's death, allows minors with funds from settlements or judgments to open binding bank accounts. There's no revenue impact. It has a minimal fiscal impact and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I've got three people who want to give testimony, Neil Jackson, Steve Merle, and Tim Martinez. And gentlemen, we have just under 10 minutes, so if you can not repeat any of your testimony that's in writing and summarize, that would be wonderful. And And whoever wants to get started.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trail Lawyers Association in support of 2687A. This bill passed on the House 59-0, clearly bipartisan bill. This is a fixed bill from the last session. Last session, a bill was passed to allow small settlements of minors' claims to allow protection of those funds. Since the time of the passage of that bill, and the original intent was, for example, you have a $5,000 settlement, you would have to use about $1,800 of that to set up a formal conservatorship to protect the miners' funds. We intended to correct that. Since the time the bill was passed, we've ran into some difficulties which we've tried to fix with this measure. One of the problems was it established, the original bill established that the funds should be deposited in an FDIC account. The banks were reticent to do that, some of the banks, because they could not contract with miners. This bill fixes that. Also, there were cases where the insurers were interested in the appropriate case of purchasing an annuity. That bill did not allow that. This bill fixes that and allows that purchase. Finally, what this bill does is make it very, very clear that nobody can touch that money once it goes into that account, including the minor, until they reach 18. Their parents can't touch it. Court order will allow access to the funds if the court feels it's appropriate and necessary. And, of course, if the minor dies, then the funds would go over to their estate. But other than that, the money is protected. That was the intent of this statute, as well as fixing the other problems that we spoke of.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Steve Merle on behalf of State Farm Insurance Companies. I think Mr. Jackson has accurately described what this bill does. We agree with it. We think it's a good idea. We think it gives the same protection, essentially, that a court would provide a minor without the expense.
All right. Thank you. Tim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I was thinking back. I think this is the first time in 20 years I've testified in support of an Oregon Trial Lawyers Association bill. So it is funny how times have changed. But we are supportive of this. We thank both the trial lawyers and the insurance industry for working with us. We did have some concerns with the bill that passed last session, and we believe this corrects them and makes us much more comfortable opening accounts for these minors.
All right, thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2687A? Not seeing anyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and we're going to take a recess for a moment. Back on the record, and what we're going to do is we're going to enter into our work sessions for today. I'm going to open up a work session on 2353A.
Mr. Chair, I move 2353A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves 2353A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions? Yes.
Is it a question or discussion?
Our discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is a bill that I've spent a lot of time thinking about and have actually struggled with. Many of the bills that we're working on this session are to conform Oregon law to the Model Business Corporation Act. In fact, I believe the next one on our agenda does exactly that. This one, however, departs from the Model Business Corporation Act, which is the statute we have currently. My understanding from the testimony and from what I've looked at is that the current statute allows a company to go up to 25% of its shareholders to require to request a special meeting. There's no indication that they've tried that approach. I also have some concern about limiting the shareholder rights, and changing the rights of the existing shareholders. I know some states, for example, Massachusetts goes up to 40%, Florida, Texas go up to 50%. We haven't tried those approaches. I have come to the agreement that I will give a courtesy vote on this. I still, frankly, don't know what I'm going to do on the floor on this. I'm hoping to make a decision that strikes the right balance between the rights of the company and the rights of the shareholder, but I am a little concerned that we're going away from the Model Act in this bill and going toward the Model Act and others, and so just wanted to get that on the record, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the willingness to have a courtesy vote and allow yourself to ponder this a little bit longer. So with that, is there any objection to the motion? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2353A and open up a work session of Chair Curie 2353A. And we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2304. Yeah.
House Bill 2304, we heard on April 30th, allows a parent company that owns 90% of the shares to notify shareholders no later than 10 days after a merger occurs rather than 30 days before. It applies to mergers consummated on or after the effective date. There's no amendment, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, move 2304 to the floor.
Senate Boquist moves House Bill 2304 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions or discussion?
I'm going to support this in the committee. I'm not quite sure what I'll do on the floor. We'll give it a vote in committee to get it to the floor.
All right. Well, thank you. Any objection to the motion? So ordered. And
take care, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Yeah, I was just looking at the other ones that we've got. That's fine. Let's do it that way. Boquist will be our carrier.
And, Mr. Chair, before you close the work session, the proponent of this bill and actually the prior include people who work in the law firm where my husband is employed. So I just wanted to
put that on the record. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification on both those bills. We'll close the work session on 2304. And open up a work session on 2310A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2310A, we heard on April 30th. It allows petitioner or party to request a court to modify certain FAFSA orders for good cause. It applies retroactively to all orders issued under FAFSA. There's no amendment, no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, move 2310A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2310A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And Senator Bonamici, will you carry this one for us?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2310A and open up our last work session of the day, House Bill 2311.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2311, we heard also on April 30th. It clarifies that the service of process under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure 7 and 9 do not violate restraining or stalking order. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, move 2311 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2311 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And
you want me to carry, Mr. Chair?
I think we'll let Senator Bonamici carry this one as well, since they're kind of in line with the one before it. So if you'll be so kind.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And as we are concluding our four work sessions,
are we down to
and
one
didn't
minute?
Gavel quite quick enough.
I'd be happy to vote.
Senator Dingfelder, would you like to register a vote on the four work session bills that we had today?
Yes. And I apologize, but my hearing just ended.
On House Bill, we have open right now work session on House Bill 2311. And how do you vote?
Yeah, I'm aye on that.
All right. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2311. And for the purpose of allowing Senator Dingfelder to cast votes on the other three work session bills, I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2353A and ask if you
I will vote aye in the committee, and I share Senator Bonamici's concerns that I had heard as I was running over here.
All right. And so with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2353A, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill, or reopen the work session on House Bill 2304.
Aye.
And Senator Dingfelder votes aye on 2354. We'll close the work session. 2304, excuse me. And we'll reopen our House Bill 2310A.
And I'm a yes on that one as well.
And Senator Dingfelder votes aye on House Bill 2310A. And we'll close that work session. And before we close for the day, my understanding we're here tomorrow at 8?
Yes, 8.
So 8 o'clock, we're going.
For the rest of the week, 8.
8 o'clock is where we're set, and we'll look at it on a day-to-day basis. We may drop back to 8:30 depending on how the load goes. With that, we're adjourned until tomorrow at 8 a.m.